It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While school buildings all over the state of Iowa are closed, school is in session on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, we learn about Iowa wildlife with biologist Jim Pease. And on Thursdays, we dig into Iowa history. You can also find support materials for each lesson on our website and Facebook page, including vocabulary words and discussion questions and some suggested activities as well. And this hour, we're going to learn about the history of childhood and how things have changed for children through the generations. With me today, Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Pamela Reiney-Kerberg is also here, professor of history at Iowa State University and author of Childhood on the Farm, Work, Play, and Coming of Age in the Midwest, as well as other books about childhood. Hello, Pamela.
Morning, Charity.
Thank you for being here. And I mentioned this at the very start of the show, but it actually can be a little bit difficult to do research about childhood because for a long time, childhood wasn't really considered to be worthy of research. Tell me about that.
Well, through most of our history, what's been written has been about men and, you know, institutions. And what happened inside of households wasn't part of the historical record. That started changing in the 1970s, the 1980s, but adding children into the mix took a long time. And part of the reason it took a long time was that so few documents about childhood had been saved. And children had generated so few documents themselves about their own experiences. And so it's taken a little while for historians to shift their attention toward the history of childhood and to do the work to dig out the information the kids left behind about their own lives.
Well, I think that also reflects how society feels and felt about childhood. These days, I think at least the majority of us in the United States feel like childhood is a special thing that needs to be protected, even a sacred thing in many ways. But Pamela, in your research, do you find that looking historically, that really wasn't the way we felt about childhood generations ago?
Well, I think people loved their children, but children played a really important economic role in the family. And that economic role was more important than anything else because kids were part of the family's survival strategy. Having kids available to work meant that the farm survived. And so that was the most important part of children and childhood, not some sort of abstract feeling of love and caring toward them.
Well, and when did children start contributing to their families? I mean, nowadays we think maybe around 15 or 16 kids can maybe get a job and maybe contribute to the family. When did kids start contributing on the farm, let's say at the early part of the 20th century?
They were in training from the moment they were old enough to help at all. I've read lots of accounts of people training their toddlers to help with various tasks in the kitchen, you know, carrying sticks in to use as kindling, helping gather up corn cobs, helping mom when she went out to feed the chickens. Now, toddlers aren't a whole lot of use doing those things, but if you get them started really young, by the time they're five, then they're actually really helping on the farm. And usually five-year-olds were their mother's assistants. You know, you could have a five-year-old take care of the baby while mom had chores to do. So it was expected that as soon as a child was physically and intellectually capable, that they would be helping.
And I think we felt that they were physically and intellectually capable far earlier than we feel that today. Would you say that's true?
Oh, very much so. And a lot of the time, a family would expect that their children would do an adult's work by the time they were 12 or 13. There were a lot of boys who were expected to take the place of a man in the fields when they were 12 or 13. A lot of girls who were expected to be able to step in and do all of their mother's work, say if the mother was ill or the mother had recently had a baby, then an oldest daughter or a 12, 13-year-old daughter would be expected to know how to do all the cooking, all the washing, to take care of her younger siblings.
And Leo, even though children didn't leave a lot of documents behind, historians weren't particularly paying attention to what was happening domestically in families, children have left archaeological records. So we do know a little bit about children and the games that they've played over time because of archaeology, right?
And not only archaeology, but just the materials that go back to the early 19th century, at least for Iowans. And just to emphasize some of what Pam was talking about, too, the things that really mattered were, you know, where did you live? Did you live in town? Did you live in a city? Did you live on a farm? And then the level of wealth that you had, did you have any discretionary income to spend on frivolous things, or were you making your own things? And I shouldn't say frivolous, but play things. What were the social standards of the period? And then were things being manufactured, a home purchased? And eventually Iowa does have state laws on some of the labor in urban areas. So you have those factors. But on an archaeological side, you know, with things that have been documented over time, either from European American settlements with fragments of dolls going back to the early settlement of European Americans, and also from fragments of playthings used by American Indians in Iowa, too. So we do have good records on things going back to the early 1800s and even a little earlier than that.
Well, and so even if children were expected to start working and contributing pretty much as soon as they possibly could, the fact that children love to play, that's something that has remained static through history. I think we can claim that, right, Leo?
No doubt about it. And again, as Pam was alluding to, if you're on a farm, you're learning those tasks. And sometimes there was carryover, and Pam talks about it in her book. I mean, I was thinking about a photo I was looking at of a boy driving, you know, a young boy driving a goat cart, a cart pulled by a goat. Well, it's a lot less dangerous to learn to drive a 100-pound goat around on a cart than a team of, you know, 1,200-pound horses. So it might be fun, but those things that you were doing as play oftentimes were reinforcing the social roles and the gender roles that you had, whether it be, you know, playing with a cast iron cook stove. So it was fun, but it often was also emphasizing the chores that you were going, or the jobs you had as a child.
Now, children today know that they are required to go to school, a school of some kind. Of course, we have homeschool laws in Iowa, so children don't necessarily have to go to a physical school building, but they have to be educated. Now, that was not always the case, but Leo, in Iowa, the building of schoolhouses started really early. That was something that the settlers who came to the state really seemed to value early on. Tell me about schools.
It's the real transformative period of schooling in Iowa starts in the 1850s when we pass a statewide schooling law. And then after the Civil War, we did provide that all students had to be given opportunity to go to school. There was no compulsory law till 1902. That's the first time there's a compulsory law. But originally, the Iowa Code and the Iowa Code, I should say, didn't provide for education of African American students until after the Civil War, or in the 1860s. And so then after the 1860s, all students had to be educated. But it was 1902. When Iowa passed a compulsory law that said all children ages 7 to 14 had to go to school for at least 12 consecutive weeks. And then in 1904, that was changed to 16 weeks. So about 3 to 4 months was when we first had a time period, and that was started in the early 1900s.
All right, and for comparison, our summer break tends to be about 12 weeks now. So it was really the reverse of how we consider the school year in many ways.
Exactly.
So when children did go to school, Pam, you can weigh in on this. School was influenced dramatically by the kind of work that the child was expected to do at home. That really took precedence in a lot of cases, right?
It did. I mean, what was written into the law was that children could be excused from school attendance for cause, and for cause meant that their parents needed them. And so a lot of the time, girls did not go to school on Mondays, big girls, because Monday was wash day. And so they were needed at home to help with the washer, to keep the babies out of the fire or whatever. And when you look at school attendance records, you also discover that older boys often were only in school during the winter session. There would usually be a fall session, a winter session, then a spring/summer session. And during that winter session, there would be boys there, big boys, those over the age of 12. But in the fall and in the spring, there often were not big boys in school because their parents needed them at home.
Well, and Leo, you mentioned the age of 14. So for a long time, getting through the eighth grade was considered to be the point of graduation for many students, right?
Exactly right. And just to follow up on what Pam was saying, too, that school law of 1902 also said that the school year would have to start sometime between September 1st or the week after September 1st and no later than December 1st. And I think part of that was exactly what Pam was talking about with, if you're needed on the farm, you might say, oh, the school year starts on October 15th after you've started picking most of the corn and the grain is all threshed.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about childhood and how it has changed throughout Iowa history. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, your stories. Maybe things were really different when you were a kid. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, historians Leo Landis and Pamela Riney-Kerberg. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, school is in session here on Talk of Iowa. On Tuesdays, we talk about wildlife. And on Thursdays, we dig into Iowa history. And today, we are exploring the history of childhood in Iowa and the Midwest. We'd love to hear from you, your questions, your stories. Maybe your grandparents have told you some great stories that you'd love to share. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Leo Landis, curator for the State Historical Museum of Iowa, and Pamela Riney-Kerberg, professor of history at Iowa State University and the author of Childhood on the Farm, Work, Play, and Coming of Age in the Midwest. And before the break, we were talking about school. And one of the special things about school for children back in the 19th and early 20th century was that school had a scheduled recess. So, Pamela, for a lot of kids, this was the only time where they actually had specific time set aside for play, right?
Yes, that is very true. And for kids, recess, I mean, maybe not everybody. For a lot of kids, recess is perhaps one of their favorite times of the day. But for a lot of kids, work dominated their lives. They had work to do before school. They had work to do after school. Their parents did not schedule any free time for them. And so when you went to school, you knew there was a morning recess. There was time at noon. There was an afternoon recess. And that was perhaps the only time of the day when someone actually gave them permission to play. And that was very important to kids. And that's, I've found a number of kids' diaries from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And sometimes they talk a little bit about what they're learning in school, but they often talk a lot about what they did at recess.
Well, and Leo, tell us what they did at recess. What would children have been doing?
Yeah, there were a lot of the bat and ball games that, basically see a lot of photos of in our collections in the Iowa City collection and the Des Moines collection of, you know, bat and ball games. But there's also tag was common, follow the leader, a lot of those games, Red Rover, sometimes Simon Says, those sorts of playground games were common through the late 1800s. And then into the early 1900s, still being common playground games. And then after the end of World War II, you start to see manufactured playground equipment becoming more and more common. So the merry-go-rounds and jungle gyms and those sorts of things being common in schoolyards.
Right. So it was a luxury for a long time just to have that schoolyard, that open field, the time to play and the space to play. And Leo, the first time I met you was at Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan. And that was also the very first day that I ever tried to play hoop and stick. So, which has been a popular game for children throughout history. I mean, it dates back to ancient Greece, but for kids who maybe haven't actually seen somebody try to roll a hoop with a stick, explain this for us.
Sure. It would either be the metal band that came off of a barrel or a small wagon wheel that was a iron or steel rim, so a hoop, a circle, that had some weight to it, and then you had a 2 foot long stick with a little 6 inch piece attached to it going the opposite direction that you would try to keep that rolling. And so it built your coordination and eye hand skills that way. And something that you could see, you know, if you could push it farther than a friend or just as a way to occupy time.
Well, and it's still a toy, if you can call it a toy. It's still something that you find children all over the world playing with in areas where they need to be a little more inventive to find ways to play. And I found it to be surprisingly difficult. I expected it to be fairly easy. But Leo, you've done a lot of living history work through the years, both at Living History Farms here in Iowa and at Greenfield Village in Dearborn, Michigan. What do you think we can learn from trying out these games that children used to play?
You know, it's fun to see how children used to play. It also emphasizes to us, you know, that things were different, but they were done both to emphasize important skills that you needed in your daily life or would need as an adult, but also as escape too. And that idea of escape, as we think of what we're dealing with now, still is an important aspect to remember that play is an important part of life.
When did the manufacture of toys and the selling of mass-produced toys begin to be commonplace?
It starts to come in the early Victorian era, and then after the Civil War, you do start seeing mass-produced toys, both imported, especially from Germany, the tin toys, but also domestically produced. So things like, wooden toys or cast iron toys. So by the 1870s and 1880s, a girl could have a cast iron cook stove, a miniature cast iron cook stove. So the predecessor to the Easy Bake, of course, it didn't have a lamp and you didn't start a fire in your miniature cook stove like an Easy Bake oven with its light bulb. But those start to come in the 1860s, 1870s. And by the 1880s, if you had a degree of wealth, you could purchase those sorts of toys.
Well, and I think that that's an interesting way to think about comparisons between how children interact with their toys and really how many toys children have. Because, of course, back in the 19th century, children would have had very few toys. And the amount of things that we accumulate in childhood have grown over time. And even as a mother now, I watch my kids, they have so many toys and they are less attached to maybe individual toys. I mean, Leo, when you look at just really the explosion of stuff, that's a big change in childhood.
And even when things were being mass produced in the late 19th century, again, the disposable income that most people had and the social mores were you didn't need all that stuff. And so having just a few playthings, maybe a tea set if you were a girl or a couple of dolls, it wasn't trying to collect and build that big collection of things. It was much different in the past. Today, the mass production of of goods, you know, beginning after World War II especially, has made toys much more common in every household.
Well, and I know that you need to go, Leo, but is there a favorite historical toy that maybe people don't know so much about that, that you think everybody should know about?
You know, there are some great Iowa companies that made toys. So Peter Marr of Muscatine, we've got some of their collections. They took scrap wood and made farm toys. They also, Noah's Ark toys are a really cool one. And even though they were promoting the Judeo-Christian, you know, story of Noah, and that was part of emphasizing morality and being a good person, Peter Marr company out of Muscatine was still making those into the 1940s. And we have one in our collection with the State Historical Museum. And I would just encourage your listeners, too, to look at your resources. We also have some really good resources on the State Historical Museum of Iowa on childhood. And so if there are people doing homeschooling, check out our resources on our primary source sets.
All right. Well, Leo Landis, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Charity.
Leo Landis is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. This hour, we're talking about childhood through history and how it has changed. With me still, Pamela Riney-Kerberg, professor of history at Iowa State University and the author of Childhood on the Farm, Work, Play, and Coming of Age in the Midwest. And before we introduce our next guest, Pamela, I want to point out something that we have heard from both you and Leo over and over again, and that is boys would do this and girls would do this. And people complain today about how gender-specific toys are now, but through history, the roles of male children and female children were quite rigid and very divided. Give me a little bit of insight into that.
Boys and girls were expected to take on very definite roles as adults. And so they spent their childhoods learning, you know, girls how to be good housewives and to manage a home, boys how to be providers. However, that did not mean that in all cases their lives were rigidly divided in these ways, because the needs of the family came first. And in the course of my research about all of this, I've discovered that there was crossover. There was definite crossover between boys and girls' roles, especially when families were facing hardships. One of my grandmothers was the oldest of six children, and her family was quite poor. She had twin sisters 3 years younger, twin brothers 6 years younger, and then another sister who came along quite a bit later. Now, her father needed help. My great-grandfather was a tenant farmer. He didn't have a lot of money. He couldn't afford to hire a man to help him. So even though she was a girl, by the time she was 10, my grandmother was out in the fields helping him with the haying and all of the jobs that had to be done outside. That was fairly common. If the work needed to be done and all that was available was a girl, then a girl went out and did what was often considered boys' work.
And looking at the journals and some of those scraps of childhood that you've been able to pull together, do you, and of course a lot of us have read the Little House on the Prairie books, and we remember Laura not liking the female tasks and preferring to be out with her father. Have you read from children who sort of wanted to rebel against those roles that they were pushed into?
Definitely. Oftentimes there were girls who really did not like doing indoor work and wanted to do outdoor work. And like Laura, they found, well, she was in a family where there were no surviving boys. And so her father persuaded her mother to let her work in the fields. And there were a fair number of girls who really preferred that kind of work. In fact, there was one diary from Kansas that I read. It's actually a father's diary. And he ended up being quite proud of his oldest daughter who could do a man's work in the field. And, you know, he needed her labor, and so he kind of forgot the inconvenient fact that she was female, and let her do a man's work in the field.
We're talking about childhood. You are welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. If you have questions or if you have stories to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And can you draw a contrast for us between childhood on the farm and childhood in town or in a more urban area here in Iowa in the Midwest, Pam?
In town, there was more school attendance and probably a bit less work, but it really depended on, as Leo mentioned earlier, on how well-to-do your family was, because there were a lot of families, a lot of poorer families. Even though they were in town, they expected their kids to do work and to bring in an income as well. Probably the biggest divide isn't in terms of labor being done, isn't urban-rural, but wealth level. And, you know, poor families in town had their kids working too.
I want to bring our next guest into the conversation. Donna Braden is Senior Curator and Curator of Public Life at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. Hello, Donna.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And for anybody who's ever visited the Henry Ford, and if you haven't, I strongly suggest it when we are able to travel and be together again. It's an incredible history destination, both the museum and Greenfield Village, where it's a living history opportunity, really unlike any other in the country. Donna, you have an incredible collection of artifacts of public life, of childhood, of how these things have changed over time. Give me some insight into what we can see by looking at the material of childhood.
Yeah, one of my projects when I was earlier in my career, I've been at the museum for 43 years, a curator, and that's how I know Leo. One of the earlier projects I worked on was a study of our collections related to leisure and entertainment, childhood and family life. And so I delved into every different category of our collections, which we have hundreds of, it turns out, related to leisure, and organized it into a book that came out in the 1980s called Leisure and Entertainment in America. It was divided into chapters like community gatherings, home amusements, sports, commercial entertainment, and travel, all categories which became wonderful research topics for me. And what I found, and this is the work that I've done my entire career, is what did the objects tell us about people and culture and trends? And so that's kind of how I approach my work as a curator. I wish I had a lot more time, like Pam does, to delve into the journals and the diaries, and we try to do some of that. We definitely do that with our buildings and the families, people that populated the buildings in Greenfield Village. But with our hundreds of artifacts we have, we tend to, basically that was my training, is how can you look at an object and find the meaning behind it? What does it tell you about what's going on? And so we, of course, turned up a lot of items related to childhood and the history of childhood through time.
We have a break coming up here in just a moment, but you mentioned community gatherings, and I do want to talk about the social lives of children with both of you. And Pam, maybe I'll let you go first, just very briefly. You know, in modern times, children socialize with each other a lot. And of course, they see each other at school, but we also facilitate socialization in some really powerful ways. Going back in time, children could be pretty isolated from other children, couldn't they?
They could, and they're probably the people that they socialized with the most were their own siblings. But they would have probably had more siblings then and less contact with friends.
And they might have been responsible for those siblings as well, not just playmates, but they may have been actually caring for them.
Oh, in a lot of cases, older children were as much parents to their siblings as their parents were.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about childhood through history and how it's changed. We'd love to hear your stories, your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. With me, Donna Brayton, Senior Curator and Curator of Public Life at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan, and Pamela Riney-Kerberg, Professor of History at Iowa State University and author of Childhood on the Farm, Work, Play, and Coming of Age in the Midwest. I also encourage you to go to our website, iowapublicradio.org, or our Facebook page as well. You can find a link to a post about today's program, including some vocabulary words, some discussion questions, and even some suggested activities. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about childhood through history. I know a lot of kids today get tired of hearing their parents or grandparents say, things were different when I was a child, but it's true. Childhood has changed dramatically through the generations. And with me to help us understand how it has changed, Pamela Riney-Kerberg, Professor of History at Iowa State University and the author of Childhood on the Farm, Work, Play, and Coming of Age in the Midwest. Donna Brayton is here, Senior Curator and Curator of Public Life at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. And I want to talk, Donna, with you more about culture for children and what some of those objects you have can tell us about that. But I also want to get to the phones. You are welcome to join us at 866-780-9100. Tasha is on the line in Mount Pleasant. Hi, Tasha.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you for calling. What's your story?
Well, so I went to the Iowa Braille School where Mary Ingalls went, the actual Mary Ingalls, and it was interesting. From kindergarten to fourth grade, I'm from Ottumwa. I live in Mount Pleasant now, but I went from kindergarten or preschool to fourth grade there, and then I switched from Ottumwa to Vinton at the Braille School from age 9 to 19, and it was very different. I mean, you know, we stayed in the dormitories, and when I first was up there for the first year, so we would stay one weekend and then go home the next, and that was different because, you know, we had to learn to make our beds and all that, and as we were growing up in the dormitories, it was kind of cool because, you know, it was like a family, and you know, you got to see different people's lives and everything, so I really enjoyed my time there. I actually really miss it because, you know, when I came home, you know, for different holiday breaks in the summer, there was really not much to do. But I really enjoyed my time at the Braille School.
It's interesting, Tasha, again, this is a way that childhood has changed really dramatically, because if you were coming of age today, you would not go away to a boarding school in fourth grade. You would stay with your classmates. You'd stay in the public school where you are, and accommodations would be made. It sounds like you have some wonderful memories. But Tasha, thank you so much for pointing out a big way that things have changed a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100. Barbara's on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story?
This is about my grandmother, who was born in 1902 and raised in Dixon, Illinois. When she was four, her father died in a work-related accident, and her mother had to raise her by herself. The only help she got from her father-in-law was being allowed to continue to rent the house they were living in.
Wow.
She tried taking in WASH, and that wasn't enough. And when her father died, her mother came to live with them, bringing with her the Civil War widow's pension that she had. And then my great-grandmother could afford to go to nursing school. She became a nurse and was very good at what she did. My grandmother was rather smart and skipped a grade. But when she was third grade, but 7 years old, her paternal grandfather said that she should quit school and go to work in the shoe factory. My great-grandmother wasn't having any of this because already she knew how important it was for a woman to be well-educated. And she saw to it that her daughter not only graduated from high school, but went on to college. She graduated from Cornell College in Iowa.
Wow.
I have a little card, an advertising card from the shoe factory in Dixon, Illinois, advertising little red schoolhouse shoes with all the little school children romping around at recess around the school building. And it's horrible to realize that there were a whole bunch of little school children who were not in school and who were making those shoes that those
right.
children were romping around in.
Oh, Barbara, yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up. And Pamela, can you respond a little bit to what Barbara is saying? Because, of course, you know, we've talked about working on the farm and working within the family, but for a long time, children also had jobs outside the family if it was needed.
And children, you know, beyond a certain point, in the 20th century, there were not a whole lot of children doing factory work because over time, there was state legislation saying that couldn't do that. But children were all employed doing other sorts of things, carrying newspapers. They worked as delivery boys and girls. They did whatever kind of jobs they could find because their families needed them.
Donna, I want to shift the conversation a little bit and talk about child culture, because I think that if you look around in this day and age, so much of popular culture is devoted to children. And there are so many products sold to children and developed for children. And that hasn't always been the case. But you have studied the comic book, which was really, in some ways, the start of a culture that was directed to children directly without traveling through their parents. Give us some insight into to comic books and why that was such a powerful shift.
Sure. It's interesting because as I've been listening to Leo and Pam, one of the notes that I wrote was the role of parents and in childhood culture, because it ebbs and flows and never quite goes away, but it has different dynamics through time. And parents and families were very strong in the activities, leisure activities of kids in the 19th century, although there was some free play. But in the 20th century, there's an interesting dynamic that happens. There's a lot of manufacturers aiming products, trying to aim products directly at kids, and often the parents go, wait a minute, we're not allowing that. We want to have a say in that. But comic books are one of those that went directly from manufacturers to kids, starting in the 1930s with Superman, and actually had roots earlier in dime novels and pulp magazines, but kids could go directly to the store and pick up their favorite comic book. Some of them were a little out there in the 1930s and 40s, Superman being one of those very staid heroes that immediately became popular and has continued through time. And one of the comic books that parents would have probably approved of for the most part. But of course, parents kind of looked at what their kids were reading in the 1940s and into the 1950s and got very nervous that kids were reading comic books that might not be along the straight and narrow, that might not be giving them good, you know, moral instruction as they turn into adults and understand how to be good democratic citizens. And that's why there was a big censorship crisis that happened in the 1950s. And the comic book companies almost went out of business because of this, and actually came in with their own censorship board. And so from that time on, there was a little stamp of approval on every comic book. And some comic books went out of it. Some comic books just ended at that point. But that is also what gave rise to all the superhero comics that, you know, had stories, sometimes happy ending, sometimes continuing into next other series. But that is really what kind of opened the door for all the superhero comics. And of course,
movies that we have today.
That's so fascinating. And speaking of that period of time, of course, radio started to be something that was commonly in people's homes, something that families would listen to. And there were programs geared toward children during that time, but that wasn't necessarily something that children would consume by themselves. As you were pointing out, Donna, I mean, there was a lot of family involvement in all of that.
Right. The radio, probably families in those days would have had one radio, basically a piece of furniture that would have been in the living room. And usually a family is kind of tuned into certain programs in the day and evening. It's something really different. Actually, this talk show is more similar to what radio was like back then in the beginning than it's become now, which is mostly music and news. But in those days, they actually had programs, programs like we have today on TV or streaming channels or DVD movies. They were programs. They were continuing series. I remember my mom endlessly talking about a show she was devoted to when she was a kid called Jack Armstrong, the American Boy, the All-American Boy, I think it was. And I was like, well, what are you talking about? But it was the most important thing to her growing up. And I think what's very interesting about radio, as I've read about it and thought about it, is that radio gave people the opportunity to use their imaginations because they had to imagine the scenes in their minds because all they could do was listen. That was the mode, just like they have now with your show. It's like, you had to picture things. And I bet that whole generation of people that grew up with radio rather than TV and all the things we have now have much better imaginations than maybe we do now. We can just see everything instead of picturing it in our minds.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We have this question from Stephanie in Cedar Rapids. She says, and this I think is for you, Pam, around what time did the idyllic American childhood, lots of playtime and little to no responsibility for several years, become the norm rather than having children go to work?
Well, it happens for relatively well-to-do children earlier, but I would say it becomes the norm really after World War II. By the time we get to the post-World War II period, there are far fewer children working, more children going to school. It's only in the post-World War II period that most people finish high school. And so the number of hours of leisure and the number of hours of work really shrank. Again, it's highly dependent on who your family was and, you know, did you have to work after school or not? But the growth of the hours of leisure and the shrinking of the hours of work and increasing numbers of people at least making it through high school is post-World War II.
And in many ways, before that time, as we've talked about earlier, children were finishing school after eighth grade and shouldering adult responsibilities. As that starts to shift, that's when we start seeing people talk about what it means to be a teenager. We didn't really have teenagers before that because people went from childhood to adulthood. So, Pam, from your perspective, and was there an explosion in that kind of cultural shift in the 1950s?
Well, there's a whole lot more teen culture in the 1950s in terms of, you see it in the 1920s as well. But in the 1920s, it's with college-age students that there's a whole new young adult culture. In the 1940s and 1950s, there's a real growth in teen culture. And it also goes along with the higher incomes. After World War II, people have a whole lot more money in their pockets in that 1945 to, you know, late 1960s period. And so young adults actually have the money to buy all sorts of records, which is how people listened to music before CDs and having electronic music. You know, they're able to buy records. They're able to go to the movies with their friends. There's just a whole lot more that's aimed directly at young people and young people who have a little money in their pockets to spend.
Yeah, well, and actually, Donna, last time I was at the Henry Ford, you had a display showing how things changed through the generations. And thinking about the 1970s and 80s, the explosion of electronic things that children could get their hands on, I mean, that dramatically changed childhood. And that has just been continuing to change yearly now. Yeah. Give us some perspective on how technology has shifted things.
Right. One of the other projects I worked on with Leo, in fact, was an exhibit called Your Place in Time, 20th Century America. And we explored different ways to approach that topic. But in the end, we decided that the approach that everybody got excited about was approaching it through the lens of the generations that grew up during the 20th century. So we, directly referencing what you talked about, we have an area called 1950s teenagers. And we have some of the kinds of objects that teenage girls and teenage boys would have had. We have a jukebox in the middle with the records that they would have both listened to. Then we recreated a scrapbook for each of them based on the kinds of things that teenage girls and boys would have been interested in. And then in the baby boomer era, we get deeply into teenagers with different kinds of music and different kinds of equipment that they would have used, going from record players and radio to stereos to 8-tracks. We do show different TV shows. And then into the Generation X area, we have the kids' examples of how TV shows like Sesame Street influenced growing up. We have an MTV area. We have a 1980s teenage bedroom that shows a lot of kind of that idea of technology has now become personalized and has gone into the bedroom. So kids, teenagers can experience leisure, entertainment, and technology in their own spaces. And that's really important at that point. And then our final section, we actually talked to kids who are now in their 20s and 30s who were in elementary school when we did this exhibit in the late 90s and talked about what, asked them what technology was important to them, and collected all the things that they told us. And we have a case in there, which is very nostalgic to people now.
I'm sure. Well, and of course, Generation Z right now is going through a very strange time. We'll be studying how this generation is changed by this pandemic, I'm sure, for many years to come, a new important piece of history. Donna Braden, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Pamela Riney-Kerberg, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome, Charity.
Pamela Riney-Kerberg is professor of history at Iowa State University. Donna Braden is senior curator and curator of public life at the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. We've been talking about childhood this hour and how it's changed through the generations. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.